Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. For the first time, President Trump acknowledges it appears Saudi journalist and dissident Jamal Khashoggi is dead.
It certainly looks that way to me. It's very sad. It certainly looks that way.
Fiery accusations in this week's Arizona Senate debate as Republican Congresswoman and former combat pilot Martha McSally accused Democratic Congresswoman Kyrsten Sinema of betraying her country during her anti-war activism 15 years ago.
She owes us an apology.
Please.
Well, Martha has chosen to run a campaign like the one you're seeing right now.
It's
where she's
treason.
Engaging in ridiculous attacks and smearing my campaign.
The midterms and more later this hour. This hour on Point, the weekly news roundtable dives in. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of the Khashoggi story and this scandal? How should the U.S. respond? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on the Twitters and on the Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in studio is Margaret Taleb, senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg, also a board member and past president of the White House Correspondents Association and the Washington Press Club Foundation. Phew. She's with us here in Boston today because she's spending the fall as a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School's Institute of Politics. Margaret Taleb, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, David. It's great to be here with you.
And with us from Washington, Fernando Pizarro. He covers Congress. He covers the White House. He covers the federal government for Univision. Fernando Pizarro, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, David. Good to be here.
Glad to have you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joined us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Margaret, and Fernando.
I want to start this discussion today by just having a little bit of a sample of how the discussion has zigged and zagged, you could say evolved over the course of the week. I want to hear how President Trump and his Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's descriptions went for the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi evolved this week, starting with what the president had to say shortly after he spoke with Saudi King Salman on Monday.
These could have been rogue killers. Who knows?
I don't want to talk about any of the facts. They didn't want to either.
I'm not sure yet that it exists. Probably does. Possibly does.
As we make a determination for ourselves about what happened there based on the facts that are presented to us, the United States will determine what the appropriate response might be.
It'll have to be very severe. I mean, it's bad, bad stuff. But we'll see what happens.
The president says, but we'll see what happens. Margaret Taleb, to be clear, this is a discussion in which Turkish authorities are saying that this columnist for The Washington Post was tortured within minutes of entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and then brutally murdered. The president says we'll see what happens. What are we to make of what our highest officials are saying?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, for journalists around the country and around the world, this is a particularly terrible story. But for all Americans, this is a story of great concern because it has not only to do with the human rights treatment of an individual by another country, but it has to do with a country that is increasingly an important ally to the United States and increasingly pivotal in President Trump's strategy about how to rethink all of the policies in the Middle East, from Iran to how to deal with the Palestinians to security and anti-terror efforts. And so the brazenness of what appears to have happened and the president's reaction to that cut a swath through everything from foreign policy and security to kind of U.S. Rights and freedoms and messages of how we expect allies and partners to behave to, of course, what hits home for many of us, which is the treatment and rhetoric surrounding journalists. I think you've seen an evolution in how the administration has talked about this as a few different things have happened. One is as some of the intelligence from the Turkish official has and the U.S. intelligence has become clearer. Two is the condemnation globally and also inside Congress, inside the Republican Party to this. And three is this conference that the Saudis had organized for next week, which we began to see several days ago, a wave of not just news outlets, but American corporations and corporate leaders begin to pull out of that. Finally, culminated in Steve Mnuchin, in the Treasury Secretary's decision to not attend as well.
I think you're totally right in the way in which this sort of almost evokes about 15 different fascinating and very troubling issues. Fernando, I want to ask you, how does this – how consistent is this with the president's approach and the administration's approach to thinking about human rights issues and about human rights violations?
Well, President Trump has treated this initially as it wasn't a big deal. He's repeated many times that that Mr. Khashoggi was not a U.S. citizen. As it, if that makes a difference, let's remember he was a U.S. resident. He lived here in Virginia in the Washington D.C. area as a columnist for the Washington Post. Even though he was spending time in Turkey trying to get remarried, but you know, the administration has had a very relaxed attitude sometimes when it comes to human rights. When it came to the time that meeting with engaging the Saudis once the administration came into the White House, the issue of human rights in the kingdom have not really been touched. They've privileged always the trade and the arms deals. I think also it's very interesting that Secretary of State Pompeo this Thursday, when he came back from his trip, meeting in Turkey and meeting in Saudi Arabia, he said that he was willing and it was a smart thing to do to give them more time. And the question is, more time for what? To admit to something, to find the fall guy, that there are some reports coming out that there might be someone that they may point, somebody who is in charge of intelligence, somebody who has been part of the team of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as being the person who maybe is responsible for this interrogation gone wrong. So the U.S., at least in this case, is trying to give Saudi Arabia as much time to acknowledge what ended up happening.
Fernando, it almost seemed to me as though, and you read about this a bit in the Washington Post itself in the last couple of days, as though the Post and was reporting that Trump and the Saudis were trying to find a way to come up with a mutually acceptable cover story rather than a mutually acceptable framework to figure out what exactly happened.
Well, that this falls into this and into that narrative that, of course, the Washington Post is taking this for a very obvious reason.
It's a journalistic crusade,
personal,
yeah.
Of course, and it's their own columnist. Okay. They published this last column now a few days ago this week, both in Arabic and in English. Yes, I mean, it seems to be that the administration is trying to give Saudi Arabia so much time when all the intelligence tends to point in one conclusion only. Give them time to have, as you said, a suitable explanation. At the mm-hmm. same time, you have to wonder how bold this operation must have been, in which they carry out this alleged murder or an interrogation and ended up in the dismemberment and disappearance of this journalist within the confines of the consulate, and whether they are aware or not, under the nose of the incredible surveillance of the Turkish intelligence
the agencies there.
Officials, exactly. They basically, what, they have audio of this. I mean, there's been talked of video. At least we seem to know that there's audio of this. Also, this has opened the door to improve U.S.-Turkish relations, which were not exactly at a good point. Let's remember, maybe it's all related, but this week, American pastor Andrew Brunson was released by Turkey in the middle of all this.
Yep.
And now the U.S. is thinking about lifting some Turkey sanctions.
So, Jack Beatty, walk us through this. Trump has, in fact, been awfully conciliatory with the leaders of Saudi Arabia, of Russia, of Philippines, of Turkey itself, places not known for respecting human rights. But the president says there's a lot of money on the table. There's the potential for an arms deal. And we shouldn't unseat decades of alliance with the Saudis over, presidents of both parties. What do you make of it?
Well, he certainly has a point, and that's been echoed by journalists and experts on our program this week. On the other side, and almost everything Trump does in foreign affairs has to be looked at least in part through this prism, On the other side, there are the president's interests in Saudi Arabia. To put it another way, Saudi Arabia's interests in him. His behavior going really from spineless equivocation to pretty much helping the Saudis cover up, coming up with an explanation for this murder, to this grudging recognition of reality. This behavior fits with what Hamilton says in Federalist 73 about the danger of foreign emoluments. He says, it would tempt the president by largesses to surrender at his discretion his judgment to their inclination. It virtually describes what the president has been doing. And here we have Fox News this week coming out with the extent, a report on the extent of Saudi money that has flowed to Mr. Trump and his family over the years. CBS News did a thorough examination of that. And you just have to always wonder with Trump, how much is this a matter of a U.S. interest, and how much is this slow walking, this more than accommodation, this seeming appeasement of this regime, how much of this is driven by the president's own interest?
We have from online commenter Nstef, who points out reports that conservatives have been mounting a whisper campaign, a smearing Khashoggi in defense of the president and his position. Nstef's comment is, there is no low that is too low for Republicans sink beneath. Obviously, a liberal critic of this, but nonetheless, very disturbing report last night from the Washington Post about the extent to which conservatives are now saying that because Khashoggi had done reporting on Osama bin Laden in the 90s, and because as a young man he had had some contacts with the Muslim Brotherhood in the Middle East, that somehow his operations were nefarious, and that might negate the monstrosity of what appears to have happened to him in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Folks, I'd like each of you, Margaret Tolliv, Fernando Pizarro, Jack Beatty, to stick around. And all of you who are listening, please stick with us. We're talking about the week in the news. You can join the conversation. Are you one of those mythical undecided voters? What issues would impel you to the polls in the upcoming midterms? Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're looking at the week in the news. You can join the conversation. Is the name Trump on your mind as you vote, even though he's not on the ballot? What issues do you care about? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm here talking with Univision Washington correspondent Fernando Pizarro, Bloomberg senior White House correspondent Margaret Tolliv, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. I want to take a couple of your calls about the Khashoggi apparent murder and also what it means for our relationship with Saudi Arabia. Jake is calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Jake, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, sir.
I have a statement, and then I got a question. My statement is, I really feel like it's kind of ridiculous that we're still talking about this guy that's not a U.S. citizen that was murdered, not in the United States, and we think that the prince possibly could have had something to do with it, and we're actually talking about cutting billions of dollars of, you know, that possibly could be, you know, creating jobs in the U.S. over this one guy. Like, this one guy is nobody. And it seems like it's all designed to, like, make a negative, you know, look on Trump. Like, and we don't even know if the Saudi prince had anything to do with it. That's just what we're speculating. And I just, I'm like, my question is like, what should President Trump do? Like, since this one guy got killed that's not a U.S. citizen again, and it didn't happen in the U.S., should we just cut all ties with,
okay, Jake.
With Saudi? And
just... Jake, thank you for that. That's actually a really good question. Fernando, what do you say?
I think the administration obviously is not going to cut ties with Saudi Arabia. It's just what Jack was discussing. We were all discussing earlier. But I think that the ties, both strategic and commercial, are huge. Saudi Arabia, from what I've read, some analysis on from the energy sector, is no longer as big a provider of oil as to the U.S. as it used to be. Still important, but not the biggest anymore. I think that what the Trump administration needs to do is try to get to the bottom of this and maybe show a stricter stance in front of what seems to be this murder, because this murder has been condemned by everybody, by so many places. I can't say everybody. I'm going to sound like Trump saying that everybody's talking about it. But but so many leaders around the world, maybe the United States has to take a stricter stance, at least. It's not what it's been showing right now, or not the attitude that's been public to many.
Okay. We also have a call from Richmond, Vermont. John, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, David. Thanks for taking my call. Just as a counterpoint to your previous caller, President Trump appears to be completely transactional in all his decision-making. And, we should have a policy and a stance on human rights and independent journalism, but also have the idea of what the players here have at stake in terms of why are the Turks providing this information. Mm-hmm. If they have access to video and recording in the Saudi consulate, are we checking our consulate? And just as, a counterpoint, he talks about the apparent death of Mr. Khashoggi and then goes to Montana and lauds a congressman who assaulted a journalist.
That was pretty stark, right, John?
Well, it begs to... It brings into question his judgment, and that's my concern. To suppose that this is somehow an event and designed to entrap someone, frankly, I don't think the world is worrying about what the president is doing when they're having their own crises.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that, John. I really appreciate it. Margaret Tall, do you draw a connection between the president's remarks in Montana and what we've all been talking about for the past 10 days or so?
Well, it feels gross to talk about politics in the middle of this, but since the midterms are a couple weeks away, let's be honest, that's the lens through which everyone is going to be thinking and discussing every major issue between now and then. And I think what Jake and John are talking about, the last two callers, is, actually gives a really good reflection of some of the divide in this country right now about why they should care about this issue, how much should they care about this issue, and what does it all really mean? The reasons why what happens to somebody who is a Saudi man living in the United States with a contractual relationship from an American newspaper, why should anybody care about that? It's from a U.S. perspective for two reasons. Number one is the U.S. getting played. President Trump and Jared Kushner have put almost all of their eggs into the Saudi basket in terms of re-envisioning how to deal with Iran, who to do business with, who to share power and intelligence with, is this the right gambit? And number two, does the U.S. still have still view itself as having a role in trying to send the right signals about human rights around the world? Why should the U.S. do this? Why should the U.S. get involved in other people's business? Well, because to promote democratic ideals and to try to make the rest of the world the kind of place where it's also safe to live and be a dissident and express your views, and to try to have order around the world, and maybe morality is too big a word, but some sense of appropriate global behavior. Okay, so why should every American care about that more than the economy or more than healthcare or more than the tax cut debate? Well, they probably don't, which is what President Trump is betting on when he tries to energize a crowd in Montana about a domestic issue. And he doesn't believe that it will impact him negatively.
I mean, regardless of how important we think this is, geopolitical basis, journalistic basis, a moral basis, very few people are going to vote on that.
100%.
Right?
Absolutely.
Right. But at the same time, very briefly, I want to get at the question of, do you think there is a direct line in the rhetoric from what the president says about the congressman who just before his election assaulted an American reporter for The Guardian and pleaded guilty to that, I believe a misdemeanor assault, so convicted on that, and what he's countenancing or seemingly kind of hoping to tolerate happened from the hands of an ally from Saudi Arabia?
I'm not going to – I'm just not in a position to make predictions about whether the president's rhetoric in the United States caused this in any way or fueled this in any way. But I will say that when the president does make remarks suggesting that violence towards journalists is okay, American journalists are concerned – uniformly, not just about the implications that has in the United States, but about the implications it has in other countries.
I want to play, you know, we should turn to the midterms. It is coming up quick. I want to play a clip of what the president had to say recently. Here's the tenor of what he has said in trying to rally the Republican faithful and the base out at rallies in sequence from Missouri, West Virginia, and Mississippi just in the past few weeks.
I'm not on the ticket. But I am on the ticket.
A vote for Morrissey is a vote for me.
I want you to vote. Pretend I'm on the ballot.
Get out in 2018 because you're voting for me in 2018. You're voting for me.
You're voting for me. But then again, President Trump told the Associated Press in an extensive interview this week he won't be to blame if the Republicans were to lose the House in November. Jack Beatty, is Donald Trump on the ballot even if his name isn't there, or is he not?
He certainly is, and he was right the first time. You know, when you look at the election, step back, there are really two elections going on. One is in red states for senators and one swing districts for House members. In the Senate, it looks like the Republican chances, according to 538, are 4 in 5 of holding the Senate and maybe even gaining some seats. The Democrats only 1 in 5. On the other hand, you look at the House, 5 in 6 chance that the Democrats will take the House, 1 in 6 for the Republicans holding on. So that's quite remarkable for a sort of, you know, spread of two separate electorates, two kinds of elections going on. And the elections are happening around the issue, crucially, of health care. 30% of Americans, more than any other issue, rank that as number one. And this happens just at a time when Obamacare has suddenly crested and become popular with a majority. 50% now approve it to 40% against. This has sort of forced both parties to campaign on health care. Republicans who voted to abolish Obamacare have been coming out and saying, oh, no, we're all for keeping the pre-existing conditions. Well, of course, abolishing Obamacare would end pre-existing conditions. And Democrats have been trying to make hay on that. But the other thing about the election is that there are two disturbing trends going on in the electioneering. One, on the Democratic side, 45% of dark money, that is money that is not required to say where it comes from, is going to the Democrats this year, only 34% to Republicans. Where is that money coming from? Who's giving it? What do they demand from the Democrats? We have no answers to that. And on the Republican side, another disturbing trend, Trump's kind of reckless mendacity, his making up of any charge against the opponent, is spreading right into the Republican ranks. We have charges in Arkansas, Republicans saying, elect the Democrat, and there'll be lynching of black citizens again. Charges of treason, charges of betrayal, on and on and on it's going. And so that can't be a comfort to anyone who values even the modicum of civility.
And Jack, very briefly, have you seen that on the Democratic side too?
Yes. I mean, and Democrats have, but it's more that Democrats have sort of been adjusting their past positions to current realities, and especially on the issue of the border. But I think, as I say, the dark cloud for the Democrats is the dark money. Who's giving it and what do they want?
All right. Well, I'd like to quickly take a couple of calls from around the country right now. We've got a call from Waupun, Wisconsin. Todd, we've got your call. What are you thinking?
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
My main concern is this past week, we had talks from Mitch McConnell about cutting entitlements.
The Senate Majority Leader.
Try to balance the Senate Majority Leader. And that was basically to try to basically balance the budget on the backs of the working class of America. And it's a major concern to me because we're going to try to pay for tax cuts to the rich, Medicaid Part D, all of our, of course, off-country adventures. And this is a time that we need entitlements the most. So that's a concern of interest to me.
And how's the congressional race looking where you live?
Right now it's looking, we've got Tammy Baldwin, who's way out ahead.
In the Senate race,
The discussion out here is, yes, that is just basically what's going on, though, here is that so many of us as farmers, we are under the thumb right now of not getting the prices that we need. And so many of us, we can't pass our farms on to future generations. We're farming, we're at the point where I can't afford seed for next year if I'm going to put a crop in. I can't afford to buy hogs because the price is so low. So I need those entitlements. I need to know somewhere at the end of this, there's something waiting for me.
The issues that that hit home that nonetheless play out on a national scale. Thank you so much, Todd, for your call. I'd like to take a call now from Omaha, Nebraska. Aaron, tell me how this election affects you.
Hi there. Well, I think it's going to impact everyone tremendously, but I'm calling because I've just been frustrated recently with national media seeming to be all over the place. And maybe this is because so much media has seemed to become so partisan. But one day you hear that the Democrats are depressed. Oh, they're not going to vote at all. The next day you hear, oh, Republicans are just not going to be out voting. And then you hear something on NPR that voter turnout may be the highest that it's ever been. And it just seems to me like there is no true national narrative. Maybe that's too much hope for one. But I also feel like many media outlets seem more interested in the horse race and whipping up fervor, just talking to voters or whatever. It doesn't seem informative at all. And I'd like to get a better sense of where the electorate is actually going. And I just don't feel like the national media is interested in that. They just want to keep us confused so we keep watching.
Well, thank you for that, Aaron. I appreciate that both for this job and my other job as a guy who covers the media for NPR. It's helpful to hear what you have to say on that. I want to take one more call, this time from Santa Fe, New Mexico, the American Southwest. John, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to talk about the midterms in the House. There's a lot of races where impeachment is not being discussed for fear that it might, again, whip this fervor you're talking about from some sort of Trump loyalist. How realistic is it that if everybody's right about the Democrats taking back the House, there'll be a sincere, real effort to try to exercise constitutional power and rein in a president who, by pretty much all standards, international standards, is completely beyond the bounds of the Constitution. And the Saudi crisis just sort of demonstrates when you have deep conflicts, business conflicts, personal challenges, how damaging that can be to the very foundations and institutions of our government. So,
well, John,
impeachment really on the table.
John, thanks. Impeachment really on the table. All right, John, thanks for your call and your question. Let me throw that to the panel. Margaret Tolliver, why don't you start? Beto O'Rourke said, I guess, in the last 24 hours, he would vote for impeachment if he were given the chance. How viable is that as an approach for Democrats? They take over the House.
I mean, this has been something that's divided the Democratic Party for quite a while and is going to continue to, at least through these midterms. And we may know more after we see the results of the House election, who controls the House, and also after we see if we ever see what Robert Mueller has found or reports to Rod Rosenstein. So I think to hear Nancy Pelosi talk about it. She still has been discouraging, trying to discourage this conversation. And there is kind of a lot of the gaming out of what implications an effort like that would have on the 2020 elections, which is, of course, is something the Democrats talk about. So, number one, would there be the grounds for it? Number two, which may be a completely different question, what's the political efficacy of it? And I think it's something that the Democratic Party is still, you know, playing tug of war internally about.
Fernando Pizarro, you cover Capitol Hill, and the 30 seconds we have left, what are you hearing up there?
Well, I think, you know, we've known for a while that the Democratic leaders, both in Congress, both chambers, have been trying to cool off the talk of impeachment. So when we hear it on the campaign trail, it's mostly campaign talk, campaign rhetoric to rile up the voters and get some energy there. But even President Trump is talking about impeachment. It's a topic for him in his own rallies to try to energize his own base against it.
Well, you've just been hearing the voice of Fernando Pizarro of Univision. Fernando, Margaret Tolliv, Jack Beatty, stick around. All of you out there who are listening, we'd like you to stick around, too. We're discussing this week's biggest news stories. You can join the conversation. A top Justice Department official says there's smoke and fire behind the Russia investigation. How much do you care at this point? What do you make of Elizabeth Warren's story about her family history? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. I'm talking about this past week in the news with Fernando Pizarro. He's a Washington correspondent for Univision, Margaret Tolliv, senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What stories caught your eye this week? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. A couple of listeners weighing in online. Roger Hunt, at least a listener posting on the name Roger Hunt, posts that civility in the Democrats and the GOP is long gone. The opposition is now the enemy. Hard to see during these midterm election season what could bring us together. Another one speaking about the question of what we are expecting President Trump to do says it's worth noting that President Carter's disastrous legacy included a strong emphasis on human rights, which in part led to the overthrow of the Shah in Iran and its devolution to a 15th century theocracy, as described there. A couple listeners weighing in. I wanted to turn to another element of the midterm elections, which is the question of turnout, and particularly turnout of Latino voters. Democrats talk about this a lot. I think in Texas, they had been staking the idea that Beto O'Rourke would somehow benefit from that. He is fluent in Spanish, appealing to Latino voters, or said to be, even though his opponent, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, is of Cuban descent. Fernando Pizarro, how important is a Latino turnout to Democrats, and how well are they doing in trying to accomplish that?
Latino turnout was very, very low. It was 27% in 2016, went up 20 percentage points. Pew Research Hispanic Trends came out this week with numbers on Latino vote this year. They are saying that there's a record, they estimate 29 million eligible Latino voters. But the key word here is eligible, not registered. It's been low. In talking about Texas, there's 5.4 million eligible voters and Latino voters in Texas. Beto O'Rourke probably needs that. But, you know, sometimes it's really hard to define if Cruz's appeal to Latino Republicans in Texas is strong enough. Interestingly, for instance, Univision just interviewed last week both candidates, and Beto O'Rourke did it as he always does with Spanish language media, did it in Spanish. Ted Cruz didn't. He never likes to talk in Spanish in public. But I think it's very important to see what the turnout is going to be. Traditionally, it tends to be disappointing. The National Association of Latino Elected Officials, which is an authority on the Latino vote as well, will come out next week with their every two years, their projection on the Latino vote. We might get a clearer picture then. But this, again, will hinge on the turnout.
Fernando, are there a couple of other races that you would point to in which you think that's going to be particularly important?
Well, we have Florida. And I think Florida, it's very interesting that much has been talked about the influx of Puerto Ricans in Florida. And we tend to think about it. I think the conventional wisdom tends to think about Hurricane Maria and all the people who left Florida maybe temporarily and left the island and settled in Florida temporarily all over the country as well, but mainly in Florida, particularly in the Orlando area. There's a story that I saw this week that nearly 78,000 Puerto Ricans have registered in Florida. The question is, and as I said before, mistakenly, we tend to think of these Puerto Ricans moving to Florida just as a consequence of Hurricane Maria. But no, that's not the case. There's been a population drain in Puerto Rico for the last 3 years or more since the fiscal crisis in the island hit really hard, and people have been leaving, and many of them have been settling in Florida. So we'll see what the difference is going to be, particularly in the race for governor. In South Florida, there's a different dynamic. You know, the Latino base is well entrenched there. There have been some changes, of course, demographic changes in some of those districts that are turning more Democratic than the Cuban Americans who tend to vote more Republican have wanted. But I think still they have some safe seats in there. But it's the key vote for the Puerto Ricans what may make a difference in other parts of the state.
During an interview with CBS this morning on Wednesday, former Obama administration official and San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro says he's concerned about Latino turnout in the midterms because numbers have shown that the rate is what he said is not what it should be.
I think what it's going to take to change that is that it can't be done, you know, the 6 months before an election or by any one or two candidates. It's going to take folks investing in a massive and sustained effort to get Latinos registered and then to turn out to vote. And until that happens, I don't think that the numbers are going to move that much.
Margaret Tolliver, it seems to me that almost every cycle we hear the importance of Latino voters and the idea there's going to be a surge, but that there is, even if there's greater registration, there's not a huge addition of Latino voters. Yeah. What's your sense of all this?
I was really struck by one of your callers earlier. I actually laughed in the middle of his question, not to be disrespectful to him, but because it resonated with me so much. He said he was so frustrated by the cacophony of different narratives about what's really going on in the midterms. And I think, you know, everybody's asking the right questions, which is, it's a midterm year. Are the Republicans who voted for Trump still as enthusiastic? Are they going to go out and vote for their congressman, or will they turn? You know, what's the Latino vote going to be? What about young voters? Typically, in the past, it's been very low for young voters. Are they energized? They say they're energized. Are they actually going to turn out? What about the non-college women? What about the college-educated women? And I think, you know, the polling attempts to measure a snapshot in time, but you could say something 3 weeks before an election and then just wake up that Tuesday morning and say, you know, and that's what the midterm question has always been. So these questions are really important. The president and many Republicans have at least been publicly talking a good game about believing that things are swinging in their favor, that Republicans could hold the House. And I think some Republicans see this caravan of Hondurans who have been moving up through Guatemala and Mexico as something that could actually help them. It's kind of a counterintuitive thought. So we have a lot in play here. But the question really does, when it's all said and done, come down to what individual people do, either for absentee voting or in terms of going to the polls that day.
I want to actually play a clip of a couple of Honduran migrants who spoke to CNN this week. There's Estras Mea and Andrea Aileman. They spoke to CNN this week about why they're making that trek from Honduras toward the United States.
There's much corruption here in Honduras. We want to work. There is none. We want land to plant bananas, plantains, beans. There isn't any, brother. We need to migrate to another country, brother. In the hospitals, there's no security. There's nothing. Our patients die, brother.
We're heading to the United States. We're going to arrive with Donald Trump. He has to receive us.
You heard there the voices of those migrants speaking through interpreters on CNN. Fernando Pizarro, this caravan, it's obviously intended to create attention. What are the repercussions of it?
Well, the repercussions can be many, obviously. We could have a second family separation policy, as it was suggested by the administration and reported last week that they are considering a new policy in which, in a way, they would give somewhat of a voluntary separation option to these families once they were detained. But this is mostly right now in the works. We still do not know the details of this. But if I may give some context to this caravan, I think there are some politics involved. I mean, you interview, I've seen many of the interviews of people that are coming up, and there is a true need. There are people escaping. There are people looking for better jobs. There are people looking for safety, people who have been threatened. There's violence in the countries of the Northern Triangle, which are Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. But I want to give some context to this. This caravan left San Pedro Sula, Honduras, a day after, last Saturday, a day after a two-day conference here in Washington at the State Department, hosted by the U.S. and Mexico, led by Vice President Pence, by Secretary of State Pompeo, by DHS Secretary Nielsen, by Foreign Minister of Mexico Luis Videgaray, in which the message to the presidents of Honduras and Guatemala and the Vice President of El Salvador, who attended here in Washington, was tell your people the message has to be don't come to the U.S. illegally. If you can't come here legally, then don't come at all. This happened one day after this caravan leaves Honduras a day later. The president of Honduras is blaming political forces in his own country of using these people as political pawns. Also, Mexico, the difference now that compared to the caravan earlier this spring is that all these countries, including Mexico, are taking a different position, are being a little harder. They're placing obstacles. Mexico announced a three-part policy to deal with this caravan just this week. They will allow people into Mexico that because coming from Central America into Mexico is a different ballgame as mm-hmm. just traversing through Central America. They will need visas given by Mexico and having passports as well. Many of these people may not hold passports. They may accept people as refugees, and they will deport from Mexico back to Central America anybody that comes into Mexico irregularly.
Mark Tal, very briefly, are you seeing this as a major element in the home stretch of the elections or not?
I think it'll be an effort to energize the base on the Republican side. I think on the Democratic side, it sort of may depend on what happens as that caravan moves a little bit closer. But there is already so much material from an immigration standpoint to kind of work with, to attempt to energize those voters. I think that's what Democrats have been already working on.
I want to turn to a different election season news story that does also hinge on questions of identity. This week, Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren released the results of a DNA test that indicates that she does indeed have Native American ancestry.
I'm not enrolled in a tribe, and only tribes determine tribal citizenship. I understand and respect that distinction, but my family history is my family history.
Now, obviously, Jack Beatty, a lot of controversy over disclosure a few years back that she had claimed Native American heritage, President Trump calling her Pocahontas. What is this disclosure to you, Jack Beatty?
Well, she hoped that it would lay to rest that smear, that really degrading ethnic smear by the president. It won't. Nothing will contain him. What is interesting, though, is what it, if you look at beyond the genetic issue, did claiming that she had this ancestry help her either get a job at law schools or get promoted at law schools? And the answer to that, according to a voluminous piece of reporting published over the Labor Day weekend by Annie Linsky in the Boston Globe, the answer is no. She looked at the three law schools, and there might have been four, I'm sorry, but I remember three, and interviewed people. Was she hired because they thought she was a Native American? No. Everyone assumed she was a Caucasian white woman. Did she get a promotion because of this? No, she got a promotion. No one knew about it. She got a promotion for being an excellent teacher. This is complicated for Warren in that she did list at some of these places herself as a Native American. Now, she said she did that out of a kind of sentimental connection to her family, to her mother, to the people who were dying, and this was a kind of gesture to them and their family memories. The point is, she did not exploit this claim to get a job, which is the charge against a false affirmative action claim.
We've got a call now from Omaha, Nebraska, about Elizabeth Warren. Jim, go ahead.
Hi, David. There's the mention of her running for president in 2020, and I really don't think she has a chance, unrelated to her Indian ancestry. I also think that the Democrats really need to identify a candidate shortly after the midterms, or they don't have a chance either.
Okay, Jim.
Thank you.
Jim, thank you so much for that. Jack Beatty, quickly, do you think that her disclosure of this just before the midterms kind of muddies the waters for Democrats as they're trying to get to the finish line?
Probably wasn't the best timing, but I think she's conscious of her competition. We read in today's paper that two other women in the Senate are getting close to announcing or coming close to doing that. And then there are the 45 other people who are running for the presidency. So she may be trying to get a jump on all that.
In the couple minutes we have left, I want to turn to one other story. It was fascinating to see that Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General of the United States, who is overseeing Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of Trump world and Russia and all that, basically said, hey, folks, there's not just smoke, there's fire. This is serious. The Russians interfered in the 2016 elections. Margaret Tolliff, what did you make of the fact that Deputy Attorney General came out from behind the curtain and actually spoke to the public?
Yeah, I mean, we heard in the last several days from two people who are both have really high stature and everyone wants to hear from, and you almost never get to hear from them. And one was Rod Rosenstein, and the other was John Roberts. And I think they make sort of a bookends of the legal community in terms of framing what's going on now. Rosenstein telling the Journal that the Mueller probe is appropriate and independent and making very clear that he intends to let this play out. And then John Roberts in this law school address talking about how the judiciary really has a different role than politicians and that it's more important really than ever basically to hold the line on that role. But I think what Rosenstein is signaling is that he intends to be there to receive Mr. Mueller's recommendations, which we now believe the beginning of which could begin to come shortly after the election, and that he is not going to be bullied politically.
Oh, plenty for us to chew over between now and the elections. It sounds like a lot more to chew on after. You've been hearing Margaret Tolliff of Bloomberg News. Thank you so much. Great to have you here in studio.
Thank you.
Fernando Pizarro of Univision, we appreciate your time. So glad to have you on the show.
Thanks.
And Jack Beatty, thanks so much.
Thank you, David.
Folks, you can subscribe to our newsletter by visiting the About page on our website, onpointradio.org. You'll get the messages there from Meghna Chakrabarty and me every single week. This week, we'll have more from Meghna's interview with former NASCAR driver Dale Earnhardt Jr., the trial over Harvard admissions practices, and the decline of the American retail giant Sears, including its pioneering role selling to African Americans. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Schroeder and Miriam Wasser. We've had help from Madeline D'Angelo, Justine Daum, and Lexi Puri. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Thank you for listening to Folk and Flick Fridays. I'm David Folk and Flick, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.